Chapter 40. Hurtling more than 120 miles an hour through the thickly layered cloud mist from 35,000 feet, Cleary spread his arms apart and faced what he could only assume was the ground, since the cloud cover hid all evidence of a horizon. His mind boycotted the frigid blast of air that engulfed him, and he concentrated on maintaining a stable body position. He mentally reminded himself to personally thank Stafford someday for slowing the aircraft. It was a gesture that had provided the assault team with near-perfect conditions for exiting in a tightly knit group and enabled them to achieve a stable attitude without tumbling uncontrollably for several thousand feet. That situation would have scattered the teams over several miles, making the infiltration of a cohesive, intact fighting element nearly impossible. He moved his left wrist within a few inches of his goggles, bringing the face of the MA-230 altimeter within easy view. He was rapidly descending past 33,000 feet. Given the low air density at this altitude, he expected to speed up considerably. Cleary concentrated on preserving his heading, 180 degrees from the C-17's course at exit time, and he scanned the air immediately around him for signs of the other men in freefall. He passed through a heavy layer of moisture and felt the stinging pellets of hail stab the front of his body, mask, and goggles. Off to his right, about 40 feet, he could barely see the flashing of several high-intensity firefly lights in the gray emptiness. The lights were attached to the top of each man's Gentex helmet with the beam facing backward. They were set in that direction as a preventive measure to warn a man falling directly on top of another at the moment of canopy pull. He briefly wondered if they might have exited over the incorrect grid. It hardly made any difference now. They were committed. They were either upwind of the target landing zone or not. It was a 50-50 chance. Only his faith in Stafford's flying ability gave him a healthy measure of optimism. In the seconds between the time that Captain Sharpsburg had dived from the ramp and Cleary followed, the point of no return had passed into oblivion. He looked down at the airspace directly beneath him and saw no one. Next, he checked his altitude. He was approaching 28,000 feet. The plans called for the men to freefall to 25,000 feet, open their canopies, assemble in the air, and glide to the target landing zone. Slightly before reaching that altitude, each man would have to initiate his pull sequence. That meant clearing his airspace and arching his body as perfectly as possible, then locating and maintaining eye contact with his main ripcord on the right, outboard side of his parachute harness. The next step was to grasp and pull the ripcord and check over his right shoulder to be sure that his canopy was deploying properly. He would need 1,000 feet of working altitude in order for his main canopy to open at 25,000 feet on the mark. Off in the distance, he could now see more firefly lights, 10, perhaps 12. The cloud layer was thinning and visibility was increasing as they penetrated the lower altitudes. Cleary's altimeter read 26,000 feet. Rational thoughts ceased, and years of training took over. With no hesitation, Cleary reacted decisively, silently repeating the commands as he executed the action sequence. Arch, look, reach, pull, check, check, and check. Cleary's MT-1Z main canopy deployed in a near-perfect attitude and heading, softly, smoothly, and without the slightest indication that it had slowed him from an airspeed of 150 miles an hour straight down to nearly zero. He was now suspended underneath the fully inflated wing, drifting with the wind like a lethargic marionette. As if booming stereophonic loudspeakers had been switched off, the sound of wind howling past him had ceased. The earpiece speakers inside his Gentex helmet crackled with static, and for the first time since he'd stepped from the ramp, Cleary distinctly heard the sounds of his breathing through the oxygen mask. He looked up immediately and meticulously inspected every square inch of his canopy for any signs of damage, including the suspension lines from their attaching points to the risers. "Wizard, this is Tin Man, requesting a common check. Over." Lieutenant Garnett's voice came over the earpiece receivers. Every man was capable of communicating via throat microphones attached to Motorola radios in a secure mode. Cleary answered, initiating a communications check that used the team sub-element call signs. "All teams, this is Wizard. Report your status in sequence. Over." Because of the lack of visibility, Cleary could not see the entire group. He had to rely on his sub-element leaders for details. Captain Sharpsburg responded first. "Wizard, this is Lion. I have the point at 23,000 feet. Also, visual contact with all but two of my men. Standing by to lead the stick to target." Stick was the term for a team of men descending in a line. "Roger that, Lion," acknowledged Cleary. "Wizard, Scarecrow here," announced Jacobs. "At 24,000 feet and in visual contact with all my men. Over." Garnett of the Marines was next. "Wizard, this is Tin Man. I have visual contact with all but one of my men."
"I copy, Tin Man," said Cleary.
Reaching up, Cleary grasped the control toggles of the left and right risers, giving them a simultaneous tug and unstowing the brakes, placing the canopy in full flight mode. He felt a surge of acceleration as the canopy picked up airspeed. Cleary's earpiece speakers were humming with the sounds of team members checking in with their respective leaders. He mentally reviewed the events that lay ahead. If the assault team had been released at the correct coordinates, they should land in the middle of a large open space on the ice near the security fence of the mining facility. The terrain afforded them safe cover and concealment from which they could assemble and conduct a final equipment check prior to moving into the assault position. He could lightly feel the wind rushing by as his canopy gained airspeed, an indication that he was traveling with predominant winds and not against them. At 19,000 feet, the cloud layers opened up, revealing the stark white expanse of the frozen Antarctic landscape. Canopies were strung out in a jagged stair-step line to his front, with the firefly beams looking like a string of Christmas lights hung above an empty horizon. Suddenly, he was called by Garnett. "Wizard, this is Tin Man. I am one man short. Repeat, one man short. Over." Damn, Cleary thought. It was going too smoothly, and now Murphy stepped in to remove any false sense of security. Cleary didn't ask the name of the missing man. It wasn't necessary. If he had a malfunction and jettisoned his main canopy, he should be somewhere below the stick of canopies heading toward the assembly area, suspended beneath his reserve canopy. There was no thought of the man falling to his death. It rarely ever happened. Once on the ground, the missing man would have to rely on his skills to survive until a search team could be sent out after the facility was secured. Cleary's only concern was the man's equipment. "Tin Man, this is Wizard. What arsenal was the man carrying?"
"Wizard, we are missing one complete demolition kit and two laws. Over."
Not good. The law was a light anti-tank weapon, a powerful one-shot, throwaway unit that could take out an armored vehicle. Two men had cross-loaded a law each, so there were still two in reserve. The demolition kit was critical. It contained 30 pounds of C4 plastic explosive, detonation cord, and time fuses. They badly needed the kit if they encountered barricades or fortifications. Of all the men to lose, Cleary cursed, it had to be the one carrying the only demo kit and two laws. So be it. "Wizard to all elements. Target is 8 miles out. Extinguish all firefly lights and maintain maximum radio silence. Close up the stick as tight as possible. Wizard out." They were down to a 15-minute canopy flight to the target landing zone. Cleary checked his watch. They were still racing the clock with little time in reserve. He hoped the missing man was not an omen. A myriad of things could go wrong in the next half hour. They couldn't afford to lose another man and vital equipment. The tailwind was pushing them along nicely. Cleary looked ahead and down, satisfied that the stair-step formation was tight
and the new model canopies were exceeding all expectations for glide and stability. The plan was to be over the target landing site at 500 feet. The mining facility was getting closer. Details of the buildings could be recognized through occasional breaks in the clouds. Now they were at 8,000 feet altitude and moving into a phase of the operation where they were most vulnerable before they were safely on the ground. At 7,000 feet, Cleary felt something out of place. He was losing airspeed. His canopy began to buck and flutter from a crosswind that had swept in from nowhere. He intuitively reached up for the toggles nestled on the rear side of the front risers. These were canopy trim tabs, which increased the canopy's angle of attack to counter the crosswind.
"Wizard, this is Lion. We've got one hell of a crosswind."
"Roger, Lion. I have it at my altitude as well. All elements use trim tabs and maintain heading." Cleary looked down and saw the icy landscape moving by, considerably slower than before. At 2,000 feet, the tailwind thankfully picked up again, and the crosswind died off. He scanned the mining facility for movement or activity. Everything on the ground appeared normal. Puffs of white vapor revealed where warm air and exhaust escaped from within the facility's buildings. It looked deceivingly unthreatening. At last, Cleary heard the message he was hoping for.
"Wizard, this is Lion. I have cleared the security fence and have visual of the target landing zone. We're almost home."
"Roger that, Lion," Cleary answered with relief. He watched as the front element of the stick moved slightly to the right. They were preparing to fly a downwind and base leg of their flight in preparation for turning into the wind and landing. Sharpsburg, the lead man, turned perpendicular to the direction of flight. The stack of canopies immediately behind him followed suit, turning on the same imaginary point in the sky as Sharpsburg.
"Wizard," Lion reported without bothering to identify himself, 500 feet and preparing to land."
Cleary did not reply. There was no need. He watched as the first canopy landed on target and deflated, followed by the second, then the third. As the men touched down, they jettisoned as much gear as possible and took up a hasty defensive perimeter. Now at 500 feet, Cleary observed Jacob's SEAL team mirror the landing of the Delta team. Next came Garnett and his Marines. Now directly over the imaginary turning point, he tugged at the left toggle and slid around 90 degrees for 100 meters, repeating the maneuver until he was facing the wind. He felt it push into his body, slowing the canopy's forward movement. Then Cleary brought both toggles to the halfway point and studied the frozen ground and his altimeter collectively. 200 feet came quickly. The ground was rushing up to meet him. Past the 100-foot mark, he let up on his toggles, completely entering free flight. Then, relying on his expertise and experience, Cleary pulled the toggles all the way down until they reached full extension, and he touched the Antarctic's ice-bound surface as lightly as if he'd stepped off a curb. He quickly unbuckled his harness and dropped the parachute system that had carried him safely to his destination. Then he knelt down and prepared his Spartan Q-99 Eradicator, locking and loading it for immediate use. Garnett, Sharpsburg, and Jacobs were at his side within 30 seconds. They coordinated briefly, checking their position and making final preparations for their movement toward the control center of the facility. After issuing final instructions to Sharpsburg, who would be in charge of the assault team if Cleary was killed or badly wounded, he peered at the facility through his field glasses. Not seeing any signs of defensive activity, Cleary ordered the teams to move out tactically, with himself in the middle of the patrol.